We're not off to Cambodia yet. We're off to Paris, which I have to tell you is a much more congenial destination. We've been doing scores of programs on fake news versus real journalism, but now, after reading Robert Darton's piece in the New York Review of Books, A True History of Fake News, we see it all quite differently. I had no idea it had been going along so often, so long, and that Steve Bannon and Kellyanne Conway are pretty amateur when it comes to evaluating their skills in the area. A year or so, Robert Darton was on the program discussing his splendid book, Censors at Work, How States Shaped Literature, and we've tracked him down in Paris to talk about the true history of fake news. Robert, welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's lovely to be speaking with you again.
I have to ask you this because it's a tradition of the program. I'm fascinated by the names behind named chairs, and you've got a beauty, Karl H. Pforzheimer. Who is or was he?
Oh, he is. He's very much alive. He is a great benefactor of Harvard University, also of libraries in general. He is a trustee of the New York Public Library. He's a businessman in New York, but who is very public-minded. So he created a chair in Harvard, and I was elected to that chair while at the same time being chosen to be the director of the Harvard University Libraries. So it was a combined assignment, so to speak.
Okay, let's jump into the topic now. Tell me about Anecdota from the 6th century AD.
Well, classicists have had great fun reading the Anecdota. They were written by a historian called Procopius, who may not be a household word, but he really is quite well known among classicists, especially for his official histories concerning the Emperor Justinian, the great general Belisarius, and so on. But while turning out these court histories, in effect, Procopius wrote a scandalous series of anecdotes, we would call them, that the Greek title could be translated usually as anecdota, about the private lives of these great figures who turned out to be much smaller in scale when you got to know their behavior up close. So Procopius created what I call a Procopian strain in the history of journalism, or if you like, the history of history, because It's a strain in which the private lives of public figures are held up for ridicule or just to horrify readers. And I see that as the long-term origin of the current epidemic of fake news.
Robert, you also write of a form of nasty news called a pasquinade.
Yes. Well, pasquinades, or pasquinades, were very wicked short pieces of slander developed by an extraordinary adventurer, poet, blackmailer called Pietro Aretino.
He's the guy that tried to manipulate the pontifical election of 1522, a household name.
Well, yes. What he did in order to manipulate the election and to tip it in favor of his patrons, who were the Medici, was to write little sonnets and to paste them on the statue of a character known as Pasquino. Now, no one knows anything about the origins of Pasquino, about the statue, but it became a kind of bulletin board in early 16th century Rome, where people had the habit of attaching bits of verse or scandalous anecdotes.
Robert, and one hates to think where they stuck them.
It's really only a bust, or it shows the upper part of his chest, and it's still there today. I was there about 4 weeks ago, and sure enough, there were lots of little bits of scribbled verse and other things attached to Pasquino. So he gave the name to the Pasquinade, even though we can't identify him with any certainty. But the interesting thing is that Aretino was so wicked and so witty that these Pasquinades circulated everywhere. And for one thing, they were very funny, so that they could actually affect the papal elections, because the cardinals were not actually cut off from the rest of the world, and people slipped these Pasquinade under the door, and they were accused of every sin in the world. Maybe the funniest one was, one of the cardinals was accused of being a mama's boy, that he was too attached to his mother, whereas the others, you know, were accused of sodomy and interest collecting and everything you can possibly imagine.
Did Aretino survive his naughtiness?
Well, he prospered from it. I mean, he was a very obscure person in 1522, but then he made such a success from this wicked improvising of verse that he began blackmailing the best-known people all over Europe, and they paid him off. So Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, for example, gave him a beautiful gold necklace, which you can see him wearing in portraits by Titian. He later moved to Venice, and he became a good friend of Titian, who was fascinated by him and painted three portraits of him, one of which is in New York. It's a wonderful, wonderful portrait. Aretino stares out of it defiantly, wearing this golden chain. He represented a new force, I think, in the history of information.
Now, if any of the listeners are heading off to Rome, the statue is just around the corner from the Piazza Navona, and I think you have a patriotic duty to put some things on it that refer to Australian politics. Let's now move on to the 17th century and the canard.
Yes. Well, the canard became another genre, similar to the pasquinade, but different in that it was usually printed. These were sheets, broadsides, printed on one side, sometimes accompanied by engravings, and they told the most far-fetched stories about anything, really, but monsters that had recently appeared, or, again, the private lives of public figures. There were peddlers who walked through the streets of Paris with trays suspended from their necks by a strap, and on the trays they had these canards piled up, and the French just loved them. They made fascinating reading. France didn't really have newspapers at that time. So these single-page sensational bits of news were a terrific hit.
And, well, you know, today, I'm now starting to see fake news as a proud and healthy tradition.
Well, proud, I don't know. Healthy, yes. We don't know who wrote these canards. It's very possible that this was a kind of news being manipulated by factions within the court who were opposed to other factions. But I think often they were written just as commercial speculations. The one that I especially liked, I used it as an illustration in one of the books I wrote, is the announcement that a Chilean monster had been discovered in what is today Chile. It had been captured. It was on a vessel that was sailing for Spain, where it would be put on display. I mean, all of this very straight-faced and solemn as a way of announcing a great event. And then the monster was actually shown in an engraving, which had a simply fabulous form, with the head of a harpy and wings like a bat and a serpent's tail and dragon scales all over it. People loved this, and I found many, many different versions of it.
Well, one of your versions has Marie Antoinette incorporated within.
That's right. Well, when the revolution came, the engravers located along the Rue Saint-Jacques in Paris simply scrubbed out the old face of the monster and put the face of Marie Antoinette in its place. And that did very well as a new version of fake news.
My guest is, as I said, the most eclectic of historians, Robert Darnton, talking to us from Paris. In talking about Paris, you seeing much fake news during your current French election?
Fake and not so fake. You know, people are trying to sift it to discover how much to believe. But there is a newspaper, which you probably know, called the Canard Enchaîné. So it's a play on the notion of the canard, but it's a canard that is chained back. And it has a very funny picture of a duck, that's what canard means in French, with an iron chain attached to its neck. The message being, there is no fake news in this newspaper. And last week it broke a story about what the man who was then the leading candidate for the presidency of France in the election that will take place very soon, François Fillon. It revealed that his wife, who has a wonderful name of Penelope, she's Welsh in origin, and the French can't get over what they now call l'affaire Penelope. His wife was, according to the Canard Enchaîné, receiving a very large salary as his assistant and doing absolutely nothing. So this news, which apparently is not fake, but no one knows the extent to which it can be believed, has probably crippled the candidacy of Fillon. And it's probably reinforcing the chances of the extreme right, Marine Le Pen, to win the election, because Fillon was the most likely alternative to her on the right. So all of this kind of gossip and revelations about the secret affairs behind the scenes of politicians is very hot right now in Paris.
Whilst we think the peak of fake news is happening around us, you point out that the real peak was at the beginning of modern journalism in London in the 18th century. Tell us about the paragraph men.
Well, the paragraph men were people who were fascinated by news, who would hang out in coffee shops and listen to gossip. They then would write one paragraph about some item of gossip. It might be political, it might be sexual, it might be something about the weather even, but something short. So usually they could compress it into two sentences, maybe three sentences. They then would take this scrap of paper, bring it to a printing shop where journals were produced, but these were, by modern standards, quite primitive journals, and you would have a compositor with the composing stone in front of him. The paragraph would arrive through a slit in the door, or maybe actually be delivered by hand, and then he would simply set the type in the next available space and along a column. So that if you read copies of these newspapers today, they are a series of paragraphs which have no connection, no kind of general story running through them. And in the case of some of them, they really were scandalous. I mean, far more scandalous than anything produced by the papers of Rupert Murdoch.
We talk about the 24-hour news cycle, the spread of news, the omnipresence of social media, of the Donald's tweets, but there's an argument in your article that even the speed of misinformation isn't new.
No, it's amazing to see how in cities like Paris and London during the 18th century, news spread orally. So there were oral communication networks, and they were remarkably effective In a book I published some time ago, I actually traced some rumors from one individual to another as the police reconstructed a communication circuit. So these were called public noises, bruit public. These rumors could spread like wildfire. And what I found especially interesting is that many of them were put to music. As I said, there weren't real newspapers, that is, papers with what we would consider news in them in Paris before the French Revolution. So where did people get their news? Well, I argue that they got a lot of it simply by listening to songs. Paris was flooded with songs. There were songsters at street corners. People sung at work. You should imagine the air filled with singing. And the singing was a great mnemonic device and a great way to spread information. So Parisians would improvise new stanzas to old tunes. And because everyone had this repertory of tunes in their heads, they could easily start singing the latest stanza about the sex life of Louis XV or whatever it might be.
Robert,
so
you're a tonic.
A great way to spread the word.
Robert, you're a terrific contributor, and I thank you for your time. Carl H. Forzheimer must be very proud of you. Robert Darton, the Forzheimer University Professor, and the University Librarian Emeritus at Harvard. Talk to you soon. And on FNL, on RN, we're about to go to Cambodia, and this time I think I've got it right.